It was as though a door had flown open inside her mind, a door she'd been keeping blocked and barricaded for a very long time. Ever since her husband had died, Mrs. Beamish had refused to admit a single doubt or suspicion about the Ichabod. Loyal to the king, trusting in Spittleworth, she'd believed the people who claimed the Ichabod wasn't real were traitors. But now the uncomfortable memories she'd tried to shut out came flooding in upon her. She remembered telling the scullery maid all about Mr. Dovetail's treasonous speech about the Ichabod, and turning to see Cankerby the footman listening in the shadows. She'd remembered how soon afterwards the Dovetails had disappeared. She remembered the little girl who'd been skipping, wearing one of Daisy Dovetail's old dresses, and the bandolier she'd claimed her brother had been given on the same day. She thought of her cousin Harold starving, and the strange absence of mail from the north that she and all her neighbours had noticed over the past few months. She thought, too, of the sudden disappearance of Lady Eslander, which many had puzzled over. These and 100 other odd happenings added themselves together in Mrs. Beamish's mind as she gazed at the little wooden foot, and together they formed a monstrous outline that frightened her far more than the Ichabod. What, she asked herself, had really happened to her husband up on that marsh? Why hadn't she been allowed to look beneath the cornucopian flag covering his body? Horrible thoughts now tumbled on top of each other as Mrs. Beamish turned to look at her son and saw her suspicions reflected in his face. "The king can't know," she whispered. "He can't. He's a good man." Even if everything else she believed might be wrong, Mrs. Beamish couldn't bear to give up her belief in the goodness of King Fred the Fearless. He'd always been so kind to her and Bert. Mrs. Beamish stood up, the little wooden foot clutched tightly in her hand, and laid down Bert's half-darned sweater. "I'm going to see the king," she said, with a more determined look on her face than Bert had ever seen there. "Now?" he asked, looking out into the darkness. "Tonight," said Mrs. Beamish, "while there's a chance neither of those lords are with him. He'll see me. He's always liked me." "I want to come too," said Bert, because a strange feeling of foreboding had come over him. "No," said Mrs. Beamish. She approached her son, put her hand on his shoulder, and looked up into his face. "Listen to me, Bert. If I'm not back from the palace in 1 hour, you're to leave Shoeville. Head north to Jeroboam, find Cousin Harold, and tell him everything." "But," said Bert, suddenly afraid. "Promise me you'll go if I'm not back in 1 hour," said Mrs. Beamish fiercely. I will," said Bert, but the boy who'd earlier imagined dying a heroic death and not caring how much it upset his mother, was suddenly terrified. "Mother," she hugged him briefly, "you're a clever boy. Never forget you're a soldier's son as well as a pastry chef's." Mrs. Beamish walked quickly to the door and slipped on her shoes. After one last smile at Bert, she slipped out into the night. Chapter 42. Behind the Curtain. The kitchens were dark and empty when Mrs. Beamish let herself in from the courtyard. Moving on tiptoe, she peeked around corners as she went, because she knew how Cankerby the footman liked to lurk in the shadows. Slowly and carefully, Mrs. Beamish made her way towards the king's private apartments, holding the little wooden foot so tightly in her hand that its sharp claws dug into her palm. At last she reached the scarlet-carpeted corridor leading to Fred's rooms. Now she could hear laughter coming from behind the doors. Mrs. Beamish rightly guessed that Fred hadn't been told about the Ichabod attack on the outskirts of Shoeville, because she was sure he wouldn't be laughing if he had. However, somebody was clearly with the king, and she wanted to see Fred alone. As she stood there, wondering what was best to do, the door ahead opened. With a gasp, Mrs. Beamish dived behind a long velvet curtain and tried to stop it swaying. Spittleworth and Flapoon were laughing and joking with the king as they bade him good night.
"Excellent joke, Your Majesty. Why, I think I've split my pantaloons,"
guffawed Flapoon.
"We shall have to rechristen you King Fred the Funny, sire,"
chuckled Spittleworth. Mrs. Beamish held her breath and tried to suck in her tummy. She heard the sound of Fred's door closing. The two lords stopped laughing at once.
"Blithering idiot," said Flapoon in a low voice.
"I've met cleverer blobs of Curdsburg cheese," muttered Spittleworth.
"Can't you take a turn entertaining him tomorrow?" grumbled Flapoon.
"I'll be busy with the tax collectors until 3, said Spittleworth, "but if..."
Both lords stopped talking. Their footsteps also ceased. Mrs. Beamish was still holding her breath, her eyes closed, praying they hadn't noticed the bulge in the curtain.
"Well, good night, Spittleworth," said Flapoon's voice.
"Yes, sleep well, Flapoon," said Spittleworth.
Very softly, her heart beating very fast, Mrs. Beamish let out her breath. It was all right. The two lords were going to bed. And yet she couldn't hear footsteps. Then, so suddenly she had no time to draw breath into her lungs, the curtain was ripped back. Before she could cry out, Flapoon's large hand had closed over her mouth and Spittleworth had seized her wrists. The two lords dragged Mrs. Beamish out of her hiding place and down the nearest set of stairs, and while she struggled and tried to shout, she couldn't make a sound through Flapoon's thick fingers, nor could she wriggle free. At last, they pulled her into that same blue parlour where she'd once kissed her dead husband's hand.
"Do not scream," Spittleworth warned her, pulling out a short dagger he'd taken to wearing even inside the palace, "or the king will need a new pastry chef."
He gestured to Flapoon to take his hand away from Mrs. Beamish's mouth. The first thing she did was take a gasp of breath, because she felt like fainting.
"You made an outsized lump in that curtain, cook," sneered Spittleworth. "Exactly what were you doing lurking there so close to the king after the kitchens have closed?"
Mrs. Beamish might have made up some silly lie, of course. She could have pretended she wanted to ask King Fred what kinds of cakes he'd like her to make tomorrow, but she knew the two lords wouldn't believe her. So instead, she held out the hand clutching the Ichabod foot and opened her fingers.
"I know," she said quietly, "what you're up to."
The two lords moved closer and peered down at her palm and the perfect tiny replica of the huge feet the dark footers were using. Spittleworth and Flapoon looked at each other and then at Mrs. Beamish, and all the pastry chef could think when she saw their expressions was, "Run, Bert, run!" Chapter 43. Bert and the Guard. The candle on the table beside Bert burned slowly downwards while he watched the minute hand creep around the clock face. He told himself his mother would definitely come home soon. She'd walk in any minute, pick up his half-darned sweater as though she'd never dropped it, and tell him what had happened when she saw the king. Then the minute hand seemed to speed up when Bert would have done anything to make it slow down. 4 minutes, 3 minutes, 2 minutes left. Bert got to his feet and moved to the window. He looked up and down the dark street. There was no sign of his mother returning. But wait! His heart leapt. He'd seen movement on the corner. For a few shining seconds, Bert was sure he was about to see Mrs. Beamish step into the patch of moonlight, smiling as she caught sight of his anxious face at the window. And then his heart seemed to drop like a brick into his stomach. It wasn't Mrs. Beamish who was approaching, but Major Roach, accompanied by 4 large members of the Ichabod Defense Brigade, all carrying torches. Bert leapt back from the window, snatched up the sweater from the table, and sprinted through to his bedroom. He grabbed his shoes and his father's medal, forced up the bedroom window, clambered out of it, then gently slid the window closed from outside. As he dropped down into the vegetable patch, he heard Major Roach banging on the front door. Then a rough voice said, "I'll check the back." Bert threw himself flat in the earth behind a row of beetroots, smeared his fair hair with soil, and lay very still in the darkness. Through his closed eyelids, he saw flickering light. A soldier held his torch high in hopes of seeing Bert running away across other people's gardens. The soldier didn't notice the earthy shape of Bert concealed behind the beetroot leaves, which threw long, swaying shadows.
"Well, he hasn't got out this way," shouted the soldier. There was a crash, and Bert knew Roach had broken down the front door.
He listened to the soldiers opening cupboards and wardrobes. Bert remained utterly still in the earth because torchlight was still shining through his closed eyelids.
"Maybe he cleared out before his mother went to the palace."
"Well, we've got to find him," growled the familiar voice of Major Roach. "He's the son of the Ichabod's first victim. If Bert Beamish starts telling the world the monster's a lie, people will listen. Spread out and search. He can't have got far. And if you catch him," said Roach, as his men's heavy footsteps sounded across the Beamish's wooden floorboards, "kill him. We'll work out our stories later."
Bert lay completely flat and still, listening to the men running away up and down the street. And then a cool part of Bert's brain said, "Move." He put his father's medal around his neck, pulled on the half-darned sweater, and snatched up his shoes, then began to crawl through the earth until he reached a neighboring fence, where he tunneled out enough dirt to let him wriggle beneath it. He kept crawling until he reached a cobbled street, but he could still hear the soldiers' voices echoing through the night as they banged on doors, demanding to search houses, asking people whether they'd seen Bert Beamish, the pastry chef's son. He heard himself described as a dangerous traitor. Bert took another handful of earth and smeared it over his face. Then he got to his feet and, crouching low, darted into a dark doorway across the street. A soldier ran past, but Bert was now so filthy that he was well camouflaged against the dark door, and the man noticed nothing. When the soldier had disappeared, Bert ran barefooted from doorway to doorway, carrying his shoes, hiding in shadowy alcoves, and edging ever closer to the city within the city gates. However, when he drew near, he saw a guard keeping watch. And before Bert could think up a plan, he had to slide behind a statue of King Richard the Righteous, because Roach and another soldier were approaching.
"Have you seen Bert Beamish?" they shouted at the guard.
"What, the pastry chef's son?" asked the man.
Roach seized the front of the man's uniform and shook him as a terrier shakes a rabbit,
Of course, the pastry chef's son. Have you let him through these gates? Tell me.
No, I haven't, said the guard. And what's the boy done to have you lot chasing him?
He's a traitor, snarled Roach, and I'll personally shoot anyone who helps him. Understood?
Understood, said the guard. Roach released the man, and he and his companion ran off again, their torches casting swinging pools of light on all the walls, until they were swallowed once more by the darkness. Bert watched the guard straighten his uniform and shake his head. Bert hesitated. Then, knowing this might cost him his life, crept out of his hiding place. So thoroughly had Bert camouflaged himself with all the earth that the guard didn't realize anyone was beside him until he saw the whites of Bert's eyes in the moonlight, and he let out a yelp of terror.
Please, whispered Bert, please don't give me away. I need to get out of here.
From beneath his sweater, he pulled his father's heavy silver medal, brushed earth from the surface, and showed the guard.
I'll give you this. It's real silver. If you just let me out through the gates and don't tell anyone you've seen me.
I'm not a traitor, said Bert. I haven't betrayed anyone, I swear. The guard was an older man with a stiff grey beard. He considered the earth-covered Bert for a moment or two before saying,
Keep your medal, son.
He opened the gate just wide enough for Bert to slide through.
Thank you, gasped Bert.
Stick to the back roads, advised the guard, and trust no one. Good luck!
Chapter 44 Mrs. Beamish Fights Back. While Bert was slipping out of the city gates, Mrs. Beamish was being shunted into a cell in the dungeons by Lord Spittleworth. A cracked, reedy voice nearby sang the national anthem in time to hammer blows.
Be quiet,
bellowed Spittleworth towards the wall. The singing stopped.
When I finish this foot, my lord, said the broken voice, will you let me out to see my daughter?
Yes, yes, you'll see your daughter, Spittleworth called back, rolling his eyes. Now be quiet, because I want to talk to your neighbour.
Well, before you get started, my lord, said Mrs. Beamish, I've got a few things I want to say to you.
Spittleworth and Flapoon stared at the plump little woman. Never had they placed anyone in the dungeons who looked so proud and unconcerned at being slung in this dank, cold place. Spittleworth was reminded of Lady Eslander, who was still shut up in his library and still refusing to marry him. He'd never imagined a cook could look as haughty as a lady.
Firstly, said Mrs. Beamish, if you kill me, the king will know. He'll notice I'm not making his pastries. He can taste the difference.
That's true, said Spittleworth with a cruel smile. However, as the king will believe that you've been killed by the Ichabod, he'll simply have to get used to his pastries tasting different, won't he?
My house lies in the shadow of the palace walls, countered Mrs. Beamish. It will be impossible to fake an Ichabod attack there without waking up 100 witnesses.
That's easily solved, said Spittleworth. We'll say you were foolish enough to take a nighttime stroll down by the banks of the River Fluma, where the Ichabod was having a drink.
Which might have worked, said Mrs. Beamish, making up a story off the top of her head, if I hadn't left certain instructions to be carried out if word gets out that I've been killed by the Ichabod.
What instructions, and whom have you given them to? Said Flapoon.
Her son, I dare say, said Spittleworth, but he'll soon be in our power. Make a note, Flapoon. We only kill the cook once we've killed her son. In the meantime, said Mrs. Beamish, pretending she hadn't felt an icy stab of terror at the thought of Bert falling into Spittleworth's hands, you might as well equip this cell properly with a stove and all my regular implements so I can keep making cakes for the king. Yes, why not? Said Spittleworth slowly. We all enjoy your pastries, Mrs. Beamish. You may continue to cook for the king until your son is caught. Good, said Mrs. Beamish, but I'm going to need assistance. I suggest I train up some of my fellow prisoners, who can at least whisk the egg whites and line my baking trays. That will require you to feed the poor fellows a little more. I noticed as you marched me through here that some of them look like skeletons. I can't have them eating all my raw ingredients because they're starving. And lastly, said Mrs. Beamish, giving her cell a sweeping glance, I shall need a comfortable bed and some clean blankets if I'm to get enough sleep to produce cakes of the quality the king demands. It's his birthday coming up, too. He'll be expecting something very special. Spittleworth eyed this most surprising captive for a moment or two, then said, Doesn't it alarm you, madam, to think that you and your child will soon be dead? Oh, if there's one thing you learn at cookery school, said Mrs. Beamish with a shrug, burned crusts and soggy bases happen to the best of us. Roll up your sleeves and start something else, I say. No point moaning over what you can't fix. As Spittleworth couldn't think of a good retort to this, he beckoned to Flapoon, and the two lords left the cell, the door clanging shut behind them. As soon as they'd gone, Mrs. Beamish stopped pretending to be brave and dropped down onto the hard bed, which was the only piece of furniture in the cell. She was shaking all over, and for a moment she was afraid that she was going to have hysterics. However, a woman didn't rise to be in charge of the king's kitchens in a city of the finest pastry makers on earth without being able to manage her own nerves. Mrs. Beamish took a deep, steadying breath, and then, hearing the reedy voice next door break into the national anthem again, she pressed her ear to the wall and began to listen for the place where the noise was coming into her cell. At last she found a crack near the ceiling. Standing on her bed, she called softly, Dan? Daniel Dovetail? I know that's you. This is Bertha. Bertha Beamish. But the broken voice only continued to sing. Mrs. Beamish sank back down on her bed, wrapped her arms around herself, closed her eyes, and prayed with every part of her aching heart that wherever Bert was, he was safe. Chapter 45. Bert in Jeroboam. At first, Bert didn't realize that the whole of Cornucopia had been warned by Lord Spittleworth to watch out for him. Following the guard's advice at the city gates, he kept to country lanes and back roads. He had never been as far north as Jeroboam, but by roughly following the course of the River Fluma, he knew he must be traveling in the right direction. Hair matted and shoes clogged with mud, he walked across ploughed fields and slept in ditches. Not until he sneaked into Kurdsburg on the third night to try and find something to eat did he come face to face for the first time with a picture of himself on a wanted poster taped up in a cheesemonger's window. Luckily, the drawing of a neat, smiling young man looked nothing like the reflection of the grubby tramp he saw staring out of the dark glass beside it. Nevertheless, it was a shock to see that there was a reward of 100 ducats on his head, dead or alive. Bert hurried on through the dark streets, passing skinny dogs and boarded-up windows. Once or twice he came across other grubby, ragged people who were also foraging in bins. At last he managed to retrieve a lump of hard and slightly mouldy cheese before anyone else could grab it. After taking a drink of rainwater from a barrel behind a disused dairy, he hurried back out of Kurdsberg and returned to the country roads. All the time he walked, Bert's thoughts kept scurrying back to his mother. "They won't kill her," he told himself over and over again. "They'll never kill her. She's the king's favourite servant. They wouldn't dare." He had to block the possibility of his mother's death from his mind, because if he thought she'd gone, he knew he might not have the strength to get out of the next ditch he slept in. Bert's feet soon blistered, because he was walking miles out of his way to avoid meeting other people. The next night, he stole the last few rotting apples from an orchard, and the night after that, he took the carcass of a chicken from somebody's dustbin and gnawed off the last few scraps of meat. By the time he saw the dark grey outline of Jeroboam on the horizon, he had had to steal a length of twine from a blacksmith's yard to use as a belt, because he'd lost so much weight that his trousers were falling down. All through his journey, Bert told himself that if he could only find Cousin Harold, everything would be all right. He had laid down his troubles at the feet of a grown-up, and Harold would sort everything out. Bert lurked outside the city walls until it was growing dark, then limped into the winemaking city, his blisters now hurting terribly, and headed for Harold's tavern. There were no lights in the window, and when Bert drew near, he saw why. The doors and windows had all been boarded up. The tavern had gone out of business, and Harold and his family seemed to have left. "Please," the desperate Bert asked a passing woman, "can you tell me where Harold's gone? Harold, who used to own this tavern?"
"Harold?" said the woman. "Oh, he went south a week ago. He's got relatives down in Shoeville. He's hoping to get a job with the king."
Stunned, Bert watched the woman walk away into the night. A chilly wind blew around him, and out of the corner of his eye he saw one of his own wanted posters fluttering on a nearby lantern post. Exhausted, and with no idea what to do next, he imagined sitting down on this cold doorstep and simply waiting for the soldiers to find him. It was then he felt the point of a sword at his back, and a voice in his ear said, "Got you." Chapter 46. The Tale of Roderick Roach. You might think Bert would be terrified at the sound of these words, but believe it or not, the voice filled him with relief. He'd recognized it, you see. So instead of putting up his hands or pleading for his life, he turned around and found himself looking at Roderick Roach.
"What are you smiling about?" growled Roderick, staring into Bert's filthy face.
"I know you're not going to stab me, Roddy," said Bert quietly. Even though Roderick was the one holding the sword, Bert could tell the other boy was far more scared than he was. The shivering Roderick was wearing a coat over his pyjamas, and his feet were wrapped in blood-stained rags.
"Have you walked all the way from Shoeville like that?" asked Bert. "That's none of your business," spat Roderick, trying to look fierce, though his teeth were chattering. "I'm taking you in, Beamish, you traitor!"
"No, you aren't," said Bert, and he pulled the sword out of Roderick's hand. At that, Roderick burst into tears.
"Come on," said Bert kindly, and he put his arm round Roderick's shoulders and led him off down a side alley, away from the fluttering wanted poster.
"Get off!"
sobbed Roderick, shrugging away Bert's arm.
Get off me! It's all your fault!
What's my fault? Asked Bert, as the two boys came to a halt beside some bins full of empty wine bottles.
You ran away from my father, said Roderick, wiping his eyes on his sleeve.
Well, of course I did, said Bert reasonably. He wanted to kill me.
But now he's been killed, sobbed Roderick.
Major Roach is dead, said Bert, taken aback. How?
Spittleworth, sobbed Roderick. He came to our house with soldiers when nobody could find you. He was so angry Father hadn't caught you, he grabbed a soldier's gun and he...
Roderick sat down on a dustbin and wept. A cold wind blew down the alleyway. This, Bert thought, showed just how dangerous Spittleworth was. If he could shoot dead his faithful head of the Royal Guard, nobody was safe.
How did you know I'd come to Jeroboam? Bert asked.
Kankerby from the palace told me. I gave him 5 ducats. He remembered your mother talking about your cousin owning a tavern.
How many people do you think Kankerby's told? Asked Bert, now worried.
Plenty, probably, said Roderick, mopping his face with his pyjama sleeve. He'll sell anyone information for gold.
That's rich coming from you, said Bert, getting angry. You were about to sell me for 100 ducats.
I didn't want the gold, said Roderick. It was for my mother and brothers. I thought I might be able to get them back if I turned you in. Spittleworth took them away. I escaped out of my bedroom window. That's why I'm in my pyjamas.
I escaped from my bedroom window too, said Bert. But at least I had the sense to bring shoes.
Come on, we'd better get out of here, he added, pulling Roderick to his feet. We'll try and steal you some socks off a washing line on the way. But they'd taken barely a couple of steps when a man's voice spoke from behind them.
Hands up! You two are coming with me!
Both boys raised their hands and turned round. A man with a dirty, mean face had just emerged from the shadows and was pointing a rifle at them. He wasn't in uniform, and neither Bert nor Roderick recognized him, but Daisy Dovetail could have told them exactly who this was. Basher John, Mar Grunter's deputy, now a full-grown man. Basher John took a few steps closer, squinting from one boy to the other.
Yeah, he said, you two'll do. Give me that sword.
With a rifle pointed at his chest, Bert had no choice but to hand it over. However, he wasn't quite as scared as he might have been because Bert, whatever Flapoon might have told him, was actually a very clever boy. This dirty-looking man didn't seem to realize he'd just caught a fugitive worth 100 gold ducats. He seemed to have been looking for any two boys, though why, Bert couldn't imagine. Roderick, on the other hand, had turned deathly pale. He knew Spittleworth had spies in every city and was convinced they were both about to be handed over to the chief advisor and that he, Roderick Roach, would be put to death for being in league with a traitor.
Move,
said the blunt-faced man, gesturing them out of the alley with his rifle. With the gun at their backs, Bert and Roderick were forced away through the dark streets of Jeroboam until, finally, they reached the door of Ma Grunter's orphanage. Chapter 47 Down in the Dungeons. The kitchen workers in the palace were most surprised to hear from Lord Spittleworth that Mrs. Beamish had requested her own separate kitchen because she was so much more important than they were. Indeed, some of them were suspicious, because Mrs. Beamish had never been stuck up in all the years they'd known her. However, as her cakes and pastries were still appearing regularly at the king's table, they knew she was alive, wherever she was, and like many of their fellow countrymen, the servants decided it was safest not to ask questions. Meanwhile, life in the palace dungeons had been utterly transformed. A stove had been fitted in Mrs. Beamish's cell, her pots and pans had been brought down from the kitchens, and the prisoners in neighbouring cells had been trained up to help her perform the different tasks that went into producing the feather-light pastries that made her the best baker in the kingdom. She demanded the doubling of the prisoners' rations to make sure they were strong enough to whisk and fold, to measure and weigh, to sift and pour, and a rat catcher to clean the place of vermin, and a servant to run between the cells, handing out different implements through the bars. The heat from the stove dried out the damp walls. Delicious smells replaced the stench of mould and dank water. Mrs. Beamish insisted that each of the prisoners had to taste a finished cake so that they understood the results of their efforts. Slowly, the dungeon started to be a place of activity, even of cheerfulness, and prisoners who had been weak and starving before Mrs. Beamish arrived were gradually fattening up. In this way, she kept busy and tried to distract herself from her worries about Bert. All the time the rest of the prisoners baked, Mr. Dovetail sang the national anthem and kept carving giant Ichabod feet in the cell next door. His singing and banging had enraged the other prisoners before Mrs. Beamish arrived, but now she encouraged everyone to join in with him. The sound of all the prisoners singing the national anthem drowned out the perpetual noises of his hammer and chisel, and the best of it was that when Spittleworth ran down into the dungeons to tell them to stop making such a racket, Mrs. Beamish said innocently that surely it was treason to stop people singing the national anthem. Spittleworth looked foolish at that, and all the prisoners bellowed with laughter. With a leap of joy, Mrs. Beamish thought she heard a weak, wheezy chuckle from the cell next door. Mrs. Beamish might not have known much about madness, but she knew how to rescue things that seemed spoiled, like curdled sauces and falling soufflés. She believed Mr. Dovetail's broken mind might yet be mended, if only he could be brought to understand that he wasn't alone, and to remember who he was. And so, every now and then, Mrs. Beamish would suggest songs other than the national anthem, trying to jolt Mr. Dovetail's poor mind onto a different course that might bring him back to himself. And at last, to her amazement and joy, she heard him joining in with the Ichabod drinking song, which had been popular even in the days long before people thought the monster was real. I drank a single bottle and the Ichabod's a lie. I drank another bottle and I thought I heard it sigh. And now I've drunk another, I can see it slinking by. The Ichabod is coming, so let's drink before we die. Setting down the tray of cakes she'd just taken out of the stove, Mrs. Beamish jumped up onto her bed and spoke softly through the crack high in the wall. Daniel Dovetail, I heard you singing that silly song. It's Bertha Beamish here, your old friend. Remember me? We used to sing that a long time ago, when the children were tiny. My Bert and your Daisy. Do you remember that, Dan? She waited for a response, and in a little while, she thought she heard a sob. You may think this strange, but Mrs. Beamish was glad to hear Mr. Dovetail cry, because tears can heal a mind as well as laughter. And that night, and for many nights afterwards, Mrs. Beamish talked softly to Mr. Dovetail through the crack in the wall, and after a while, he began to talk back. Mrs. Beamish told Mr. Dovetail how terribly she regretted telling the kitchen maid what he had said about the Ichabod, and Mr. Dovetail told her how wretched he'd felt afterwards for suggesting that Major Beamish had fallen off his horse. And each promised the other that their child was alive, because they had to believe it or die. A freezing chill was now stealing into the dungeons through its one high, tiny, barred window. The prisoners could tell a hard winter was approaching, yet the dungeon had become a place of hope and healing. Mrs. Beamish demanded more blankets for all her helpers and kept her stove burning all night, determined that they would survive. Chapter 48. Bert and Daisy Find Each Other. The chill of winter was felt in Ma Grunter's orphanage, too. Children in rags, who are fed only on cabbage soup, cannot withstand coughs and colds as easily as children who are well fed. The little cemetery at the back of the orphanage saw a steady stream of Johns and Janes who had died for lack of food and warmth and love, and they were buried without anybody knowing their real names, although the other children mourned them. The sudden spate of deaths was the reason Ma Grunter had sent Basher John out onto the streets of Jeroboam to round up as many homeless children as he could find to keep up her numbers. Inspectors came to visit 3 times a year to make sure she wasn't lying about how many children were in her care. She preferred to take in older children, if possible, because they were hardier than the little ones. The gold she received for each child had now made Ma Grunter's private rooms in the orphanage some of the most luxurious in cornucopia, with a blazing fire and deep velvet armchairs, thick silk rugs, and a bed with soft woolen blankets. Her table was always provided with the finest food and wine. The starving children caught whiffs of heaven as Baronstown pies and Curdsburg cheeses passed into Ma Grunter's apartment. She rarely left her rooms now, except to greet the inspectors, leaving Basher John to manage the children. Daisy Dovetail paid little attention to the 2 new boys when they first arrived. They were dirty and ragged, as were all newcomers, and Daisy and Martha were busy trying to keep as many of the smaller children alive as was possible. They went hungry themselves to make sure the little ones got enough to eat, and Daisy carried bruises from Basher John's cane because she often inserted herself between him and a smaller child he was trying to hit. If she thought about the new boys at all, it was to despise them for agreeing to be called John without putting up any sort of fight. She wasn't to know that it suited the 2 boys very well for nobody to know their real names. A week after Bert and Roderick arrived at the orphanage, Daisy and her best friend Martha held a secret birthday party for Hetty Hopkins' twins. Many of the youngest children didn't know when their birthdays were, so Daisy picked a date for them and always made sure it was celebrated, if only with a double portion of cabbage soup. She and Martha always encouraged the little ones to remember their real names, too, although they taught them to call each other John and Jane in front of Basher John. Daisy had a special treat for the twins. She'd actually managed to steal 2 real Shoeville pastries from a delivery for Ma Grunter several days before and saved them for the twins' birthday, even though the smell of the pastries had tortured Daisy and it had been hard to resist eating them herself.
"Oh, it's lovely," sighed the little girl through tears of joy.
"Lovely," echoed her brother.
Those came from Shoeville, which is the capital, Daisy told them. She tried to teach the smaller children the things she remembered from her own interrupted school days, and often described the cities they'd never seen. Martha liked hearing about Curdsburg, Baronstown and Shoeville too, because she'd never lived anywhere but the marshlands and Ma Grunter's orphanage. The twins had just swallowed the last crumbs of their pastries when Basher John came bursting into the room. Daisy tried to hide the plate, on which was a trace of cream, but Basher John had spotted it. "You!" he bellowed, approaching Daisy with the cane held up over his head. "Have been stealing again, ugly Jane!" He was about to bring it down on her when he suddenly found it caught in mid-air. Bert had heard the shouting and gone to find out what was going on. Seeing that Basher John had cornered a skinny girl in much-patched overalls, Bert grabbed and held the cane on the way down. "Don't you dare," Bert told Basher John in a low growl. For the first time, Daisy heard the new boy's Shoeville accent. But he looked so different to the Bert she'd once known, so much older, so much harder-faced, that she didn't recognize him. As for Bert, who remembered Daisy as a little olive-skinned girl with brown pigtails, he had no idea he'd ever met the girl with the burning eyes before. Basher John tried to pull his cane free of Bert's grip, but Roderick came to Bert's aid. There was a short fight, and for the first time in any of the children's memories, Basher John lost. Finally, vowing revenge, he left the room with a cut lip, and word spread in whispers around the orphanage that the two new boys had rescued Daisy and the twins, and that Basher John had slunk off looking stupid. Later that evening, when all the orphanage children were settling down for bed, Bert and Daisy passed each other on an upstairs landing, and they paused a little awkwardly to talk to each other. "Thank you very much," said Daisy, "for earlier."
"You're welcome," said Bert. "Does he often behave like that?"
"Quite often," said Daisy with a little shrug, "but the twins got their pastries. I'm very grateful." Bert now thought he saw something familiar in the shape of Daisy's face and heard the trace of Shoeville in her voice. Then he looked down at the ancient, much-washed overalls, onto which Daisy had had to sew extra lengths to the legs. "What's your name?" he asked. Daisy glanced around to make sure they weren't being overheard. "Daisy," she said, "but you must remember to call me Jane when Basher John's around."
"Daisy!" gasped Bert. "Daisy! It's me! Bert Beamish!"
Daisy's mouth fell open, and before they knew it, they were hugging and crying as though they'd been transformed back into small children in those sunlit days in the palace courtyard, before Daisy's mother had died and Bert's father had been killed, when Cornucopia had seemed the happiest place on earth. Chapter 49. Escape from Ma Grunter's. Children generally stayed at Ma Grunter's orphanage until she threw them out onto the street. She received no gold for looking after grown men and women, and had allowed Basher John to stay only because he was useful to her. While they were still worth gold, Ma Grunter made sure no children escaped by keeping all doors securely locked and bolted. Only Basher John had keys, and the last boy who'd tried to steal them had spent months recovering from his injuries. Daisy and Martha both knew the time was coming when they'd be thrown out, but they were less worried for themselves than for what would become of the little ones once they were gone.
Bert and Roderick knew they'd have to leave around the same time, if not sooner. They weren't able to check and see whether wanted posters with Bert's face on them were still stuck to the walls of Jeroboam, but it seemed unlikely they'd been taken down. The four lived in daily dread that Ma Grunter and Basher John would realize they had a valuable fugitive worth 100 gold ducats under their roof. In the meantime, Bert, Daisy, Martha, and Roderick met every night while the other children were asleep to share their stories and pool their knowledge about what was going on in Cornucopia. They held these meetings in the only place Basher John never went, the large cabbage cupboard in the kitchen. Roderick, who had been raised to make jokes about the marshlanders, laughed at Martha's accent during the first of these meetings, but Daisy told him off so fiercely that he didn't do it again. Huddled around a single candle as though it were a fire, amid mounds of tough, smelly cabbages, Daisy told the boys about her kidnap. Bert shared his fear that his father had died in some kind of accident. And Roderick explained about the way the Dark Footers faked attacks on towns to keep people believing in the Ichabod. He also told the others about how the mail was intercepted, how the two lords were stealing wagon loads of gold from the country, and that hundreds of people had been killed, or, if they were useful to Spittleworth in some way, imprisoned. However, each of the boys was hiding something, and I'll tell you what it was. Roderick suspected that Major Beamish had been accidentally shot on the marsh all those years ago, but he hadn't told Bert that because he was scared his friend would blame him for not telling him sooner. Meanwhile, Bert, who was certain Mr. Dovetail had carved the giant feet the Dark Footers were using, didn't tell Daisy so. You see, he was certain Mr. Dovetail must have been killed after making them, and he didn't want to give Daisy false hope that he was still alive. As Roderick didn't know who'd carved the many sets of feet used by the Dark Footers, Daisy had no idea about her father's part in the attacks. "But what about the soldiers?" Daisy asked Roderick on the sixth night they met in the cabbage cupboard. "The Ichabod Defence Brigade and the Royal Guard, are they in on it?" "I think they must be a bit," said Roderick, "but only the very top people know everything. The two lords and whoever's replaced my father," he said, and fell silent for a while. "The soldiers must know there is no Ichabod," said Bert, "after all the time they've spent up in the marshlands." "There is an Ichabod, though," said Martha. Roddy didn't laugh, though he might have done if he'd just met her. Daisy ignored Martha, as she usually did, but Bert said kindly, "I believed in it myself until I realized what was really going on." The foursome went off to bed later that night, agreeing to meet again the following evening. Each was burning with the ambition to save the country, but they kept coming back to the fact that, without weapons, they could hardly fight Spittleworth and his many soldiers. However, when the girls arrived in the cabbage cupboard on the seventh night, Bert knew from their expressions that something bad had happened. "Trouble," whispered Daisy, as soon as Martha had closed the cupboard door. "We heard Ma Grunter and Basher John talking just before we went to bed. There's an orphanage inspector on the way. He'll be here tomorrow afternoon." The boys looked at each other, extremely worried. The last thing they wanted was for an outsider to recognize them as two fugitives. "We have to leave," said Bert to Roderick. "Now, tonight. Together, we can manage to get the keys from Basher John."
"I'm game," said Roderick, clenching his fists.
"Well, Martha and I are coming with you," said Daisy. "We've thought of a plan."
"What plan?"
asked Bert. "I say
The four of us head north to the soldiers' camp in the marshlands, said Daisy. Martha knows the way. She can guide us. When we get there, we tell the soldiers everything Roderick's told us about the Ichabod being fake. It's real, though, said Martha, but the other three ignored her. And about the killings and all the gold Spittleworth and Flapoon are stealing from the country. We can't take on Spittleworth alone. There must be some good soldiers who'd stop obeying him and help us take the country back.
It's a good plan, said Bert slowly, but I don't think you girls should come. It might be dangerous. Roderick and I will do it.
No, Bert, said Daisy, her eyes almost feverish. With four of us, we double the number of soldiers we can talk to. Please don't argue. Unless something changes, soon most of the children in this orphanage will be in that cemetery before the winter's over.
It took a little more argument for Bert to agree that the two girls should come, because he privately worried that Daisy and Martha were too frail to make the journey. But at last he agreed.
All right, you better grab your blankets off your beds, because it's going to be a long, cold walk. Roddy and I will deal with Basher John. So Bert and Roderick sneaked into Basher John's room. The fight was short and brutal. It was lucky Ma Grunter had drunk two whole bottles of wine with her dinner, because otherwise all the banging and shouting would definitely have woken her. Leaving Basher John bloody and bruised, Roderick stole his boots. Then they locked him in his own room, and the two boys sprinted to join the girls, who were waiting beside the front door. It took 5 long minutes to unfasten all the padlocks and loosen all the chains. A blast of icy air met them as they opened the door. With one last glance back at the orphanage, threadbare blankets around their shoulders, Daisy, Bert, Martha and Roderick slipped out onto the street and set off for the marshlands through the first few flakes of snow. Chapter 50 A Winter's Journey. No harder journey had been made in all of Cornucopia's history than the trek of those four young people to the marshlands. It was the bitterest winter the kingdom had seen for 100 years, and by the time the dark outline of Jeroboam had vanished behind them, the snow was falling so thickly it dazzled their eyes with whiteness. Their thin, patched clothes and their torn blankets were no match for the freezing air, which bit at every part of them like tiny, sharp-toothed wolves. If not for Martha, it would have been impossible to find their way, but she was familiar with the country north of Jeroboam, and in spite of the thick snow now covering every landmark, she recognized old trees she used to climb, odd-shaped rocks that had always been there, and ramshackle sheepsheds that had once belonged to neighbors. Even so, the further north they traveled, the more all of them wondered in their hearts whether the journey would kill them, though they never spoke the thought aloud. Each felt their body plead with them to stop, to lie down in the icy straw of some abandoned barn and give up. On the third night, Martha knew they were close because she could smell the familiar ooze and brackish water of the marsh.